Okay, so let's begin with our motivation. So looking for some kind of satisfactory happiness or peace in samsara is a hopeless endeavor. So sure, we can try and make our samsara better. And it certainly makes sense. All of us want to avoid pain and to have pleasure. But to always keep in mind that our endeavor to tweak our samsara is always going to be less than satisfactory, because the very nature of cyclic existence is to be under the control of afflictions and karma. And since afflictions are distorted states of mind, they are going to produce perceptions, or they are perceptions that are distorted, and they're going to produce actions that are also distorted. So really, our only choice for some kind of satisfactory existence and peaceful existence is to be free of cyclic existence and attain liberation or full awakening. So we want to endeavor to actualize those for ourselves, but it's important to remember that everybody else is in the same boat. And everybody else, like us, wants happiness, doesn't want suffering, is constantly met by disappointment and disillusionment. And, just like us, has moments of happiness that don't last. So this is not a pessimistic view, it's a realistic one, and it also proposes an alternative. And so let's seek the alternative, the bliss of liberation, the total fulfillment of full awakening, which are states of mind that we can actually cultivate. So let's aim towards this, and let's help each other, and let's help all sentient beings go in that direction. So with that in mind, we'll learn about reasoning and debate this evening, because reasoning and debate will help us clarify our thoughts and think more realistically and even gain non-conceptual realizations that are more realistic. So some people might say, but I think that's pretty pessimistic. I think it would be pessimistic if there were no alternative. If the Buddha just described true dukkha and its origins and left it at that, then sure, you know, that's pretty discouraging. But he, you know, described an alternative and taught us how to go about actualizing that alternative. And so in that ways, it's not discouraging at all. It's actually quite optimistic. Yeah, because when you think of it, in samsara, our definition of optimism is just another state of, you know, hoping to get some kind of transitory pleasure. Yeah. Whereas the optimism that the Buddha is presenting is an actual state of lasting peace and bliss and fulfillment. Okay, so let's aim for that. The thing is, you know, we haven't experienced that, so then we go, well, how do I know it exists? Whereas, you know, a buzz in samsara, yeah, we've experienced that. We know that exists. But something that's beyond samsara, we haven't experienced. So our mind goes, oh, how do I know that's really possible? But I think the way I've figured it out is that, you know, if I look at the difficulties and the pain in samsara, and then I think of not having that, that alone is really good. Yeah. So, and then you read about the Buddha's qualities and hear that the Buddha was once a sentient being like us, same problems, same bad habits, same judgmental mind. And yet he was able to complete this total internal transformation and gain awakening. So why can't we too? Yeah? Okay. So I asked you to do a little exercise last week that I don't know if anybody did, but Venerable Jompa did it. Did any of you do it? I didn't think so. But Venerable Jompa did it. Okay? So she wrote an email. She said, just to start out with, that she liked the antidote of questioning, why am I angry? You know, to keep asking ourselves, why am I angry? Why am I angry? She said that was very helpful. And then she said, I too try to do a syllogism as you suggested us to do. And you are right, such syllogisms do not hold. And then she gave an attempt. Yeah, remember I asked you to write syllogisms? Yeah, nobody did it, right? Yeah, oh, that's, yeah, I'm a very successful teacher. Yeah, ask students to do things, they forget, they disregard. Okay, but one person came through. So, she said, here's her syllogism. A person who is not liked is justified in being angry because she fears for her own well-being. Okay, a person who is not liked is justified in being angry because she feels for her own well-being. She also said, you could say, because she feels for her, fears for her life. But I think that one's a little bit too extreme. We'll just keep that she fears for her own well-being. So she said, the subject is a person who is not liked. The predicate is justified in being angry. And the reason is because she fears for her own well-being. Okay. Now, what's the property? What's the presence of the reason in the subject? Okay. So, a person who is not liked fears for her own well-being. What do you think about that? Not necessarily. Why not?
I don't really see that there's any particular connection between not being liked and fearing for their well-being. Yeah. I mean, there's not necessarily a connection.
Yeah, so there's not necessarily a connection between people not liking you and then needing to be afraid for your well-being. But in some people's mind, there is that connection. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as soon as somebody doesn't like them, they go into defensive mode and think that person is going to attack or destroy them or harm them in some way. But that's not a very realistic response because, as you noted, it, you know, a person who is not liked doesn't necessarily fear for their own well-being. Yeah, those two things don't have to go together. Yeah. Imagine what would happen, what your mind would be like if every time you encountered somebody who didn't like you, you got afraid for your own well-being.
No need to imagine. I've experienced that.
You've experienced it. So you think that it's that the presence of the reason and the property is...
No, no, I don't.
Why not? If you've experienced that.
You said imagine how it would feel if every time you were afraid that you weren't liked, you would feel for your well-being. Mm-hmm. So I have experienced where times in my life when I have had that feeling. Mm-hmm. I don't need to imagine it, and it's not true.
Okay, okay. So you can experience something based on a mental state
yes.
that is totally untrue and distorted.
But there's other responses. That's what makes it not hold.
Yeah, there's also other responses to not being liked. For example,
Being depressed.
Being depressed. What else?
Considering the feedback and seeing if it's accurate or not.
Yeah. So considering the criticism and seeing if it's accurate or not. If you were disliked by a bunch of neo-Nazis, would you be depressed? Yeah, what would you be? Fearful?
I think I would fear for my well-being.
You would fear for your well-being? If neo-Nazis didn't like you?
If they were around, yeah, more concerning.
Yeah? I would feel rather complimented. Yeah? If those people thought poorly of me and didn't like me, you know, then, well, that's okay. Yeah? I'm not looking for those people's approval. Quite interesting, our different responses to thinking of not being liked.
But isn't there a fault even...
in the subject, isn't there a fault even in the subject? Because how do you measure not being liked?
Yeah.
That's a
subjective
very
thing
subjective.
Of somebody who feels that they are not liked.
Yeah,
but of course we can think that we're not liked, and that could be a total hallucination too.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay. So then, what's the pervasion? So we found out that the property doesn't work. So, you know, she's trying to give a good syllogism, and she herself said it doesn't work. But it's very interesting because this is the kind of syllogism our mind makes up. And unless we put it down and see if it works, we're never going to really see how it doesn't work. We're going to continue believing that it does work. Okay, so what's the pervasion in this syllogism?
If you fear for your well-being, you are necessarily justified in being angry?
Yeah, so if you fear for your well-being, then you're justified in being angry. Is that true or not? No pervasion. Why not?
Anger is never justified as a wrong consciousness.
Yeah.
There are many responses other than anger.
Yeah. So anger is a wrong consciousness. And if what we mean by justified is, you know, it produces benefit or it's good for the world or something like that, then that doesn't hold. Yeah. Yet when we're angry, we feel like it's justified, don't we? Yeah. But is our anger ever really justified? Is a wrong consciousness ever even, you know, ever really justified in the sense of, you know, being a valid way to perceive the world?
I find it helpful to look at why do we want to justify something that doesn't benefit us, that actually hurts us? It's like,
yeah.
I have the right to be angry and I'm justified with my afflictions, and it's like being justified to have a cold.
Yeah.
Or the flu.
Yeah, yeah. But that's interesting, isn't it? How we want to justify something that actually harms us and that we're actually miserable when it's happening. Isn't that curious? That we want to prove that it's justified and it's correct and it's beneficial. Yeah.
But also, if we are afraid for our own well-being, anger does not mitigate that fear. So anger is not really helping us address the our basic, our state of fear. It does not produce a different state of mind.
Yeah.
So it just adds on to
it. Right, right. It, yeah. And it anger actually... You know, people think it mitigates their fear because when you're afraid, you feel like you have no power. When you're angry, you feel like you have power. And when you have power, then you tell yourself, I don't have to be afraid because I can beat the other guy in some way. Yeah? So it's a whole distorted state of mind and justification because... You know, if we're afraid, the anger doesn't really solve the cause of the fear at all. Yeah, it just is dancing around the whole thing. Yeah, and you see, so you know, we're afraid, then we get angry, so we have some feeling of power, then we attack the other person or the other country or whatever. Yeah. And does that, and actually when you attack and go to war, you're afraid, aren't you? Yeah. But you're talked into this thing of, well, those people are inferior, so what I'm doing is good. But, you know, I don't think really people's minds are unafraid when they're going into war.
There's also another dynamic, and that is that if there seems to be some sense about that the angrier that I get or the angrier that I make myself to be, then the more I have an enhanced ability to make a change on the situation. Mm. And so what I have observed in some instances is that if people get some kind of good result with that strategy of showing anger, mm-hmm. and then being able to influence the situation, like the other person backs down or, you know, things go the way they want it, then that's kind of a reinforcement for that behavior in the future.
Yeah.
And so they continue to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that reinforces our distorted pervasion that if you're angry, if you fear for your well-being, anger is justified. Yeah.
And we don't actually know when we're miserable. You know, and to even use the reasoning that when I'm angry, I'm miserable. It's a miserable mind. We don't know. We're so used to being miserable that we don't know.
No,
when
we're miserable.
And when
yes,
we're not.
Yes. Yep. That's it. So I think it's really good that she tried to make some kind of reasoning here. You know, for anger to really see if it worked. You know, and. And I think she was basing, you know, she was looking inside and seeing how her own mind thought. And then, you know, showing to herself, oh, this way of thinking doesn't make any sense. Yeah. So that was the whole purpose of the exercise. And I think she did a good job. She said, anger is a choice, just as love is. Even in our legislature, you can't find a law that says that citizens are justified being angry if they are not being liked. Yeah, it's true. There's no law that validates that even in conventional society. Then she tried some other syllogisms. Okay. So a person who is hated by others will face strong emotions because she is going to be destroyed.
Woo! Okay.
That's quite a theme going.
Yes. Well, the thing was to come up with something that justifies anger. Mm-hmm. You know? The next one was, a person who is hated by others will face strong emotions because her mind will be negatively influenced. A person who is hated by others will face strong emotions because her mind will be negatively influenced.
Property, the subject, is not necessarily established. Just because you're hated by others doesn't mean that you will be
negatively influenced, right? So the property isn't part of the subject. Just because you're hated by others, it doesn't mean you'll necessarily be negatively influenced. Yeah. Can you think of an example? Have you ever been hated without being negatively influenced? Or can you, maybe we've never been that, but maybe we can imagine being that?
I remember once when someone was quite upset with me, but I never felt one moment of problems because I did something that was needed to be done, and they were very upset. But I never, actually my whole family was upset with me for years.
Yeah.
And I never lost a moment of sleep over this because I knew what I did was right.
Yeah. It's a very good example. Yeah. So of even, you know, people hate you, your mind doesn't have to be negatively influenced because, like, you thought about what you did, you knew what you did was the correct thing to do. So other people don't like it, what to do?
Yeah. ISIS. People, they hate us because of we're not like them. That doesn't necessarily negative influence me because I don't know most of them. Yeah, they're not in my purview.
Okay, yeah. So you may not know the people who say they hate you, and so
even if they do, they're half a world away from me.
Yeah.
So
it doesn't necessarily negatively influence you. Yeah. And what about the pervasion? Yeah, so the property doesn't work. Then what would the pervasion be? Okay, a person who is hated by others will face strong emotions because her mind will be negatively influenced. What's the pervasion?
If you are negatively influenced, you will necessarily experience strong emotions.
Okay, so if your mind is negatively influenced, you will necessarily face strong emotions. What does it mean that your mind is negatively influenced? That seems to mean that you face strong emotions. But
you have weak negative.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't have strong emotions.
Oh, okay. If you had a weak negative mind, you wouldn't have strong emotions. Yeah. Okay. So she said, this all would not work. She said the pervasion does not hold, but actually it's the property too that doesn't hold. Yeah, she just talks about making the circles, you know, to show when you're doing the property and all these things. So, very good. I think that's good. So, okay, homework next week. And if you don't do it, I will leave so that you can do your homework. Okay, so think of some syllogisms, how you're thinking. Look in your own mind and think of a syllogism about how you justify some behavior or some emotion. Okay, then we will go to the text. So we've been talking about divisions of the existence into functioning things and non-functioning things, permanent and impermanent phenomena. You never say permanent and impermanent things, because things is always talking about functioning things. You have to say phenomena. Okay. And then ultimate truths and conventional truths, produced phenomena and unproduced phenomena. Okay, so we've been talking about all these classifications. Ultimate and conventional truths. Every one of the Buddhist tenet systems explains the division of existence into two truths, ultimate truths and conventional truths. Okay, however, only the sutra school following reasoning, which is the point of view of the collected topic system of Buddhist reasoning and debate, equates ultimate truths with impermanent phenomena. This system, an ultimate truth, is defined as a phenomena that is ultimately able to perform a function. Okay? So every Buddhist system has a different definition of ultimate and conventional truths. And with some of, when we look at the Chittamatra and Manyamaka system, that division centers around how something exists. Here, it is not talking about how something exists. Ultimate and conventional truths doesn't refer to how something exists. It refers to whether it functions or doesn't function. Yeah. In the Vaivasika, it refers to, whether things disappear when you analyze them into small parts or don't disappear. So these things, the divisions into ultimate and conventional truths don't necessarily concern the existence, the mode of existence, the deeper mode of existence of phenomena. Okay, so that's something important to realize. Otherwise, we go in, if we think that that's what all the schools are pointing out, then we say, that's rather confusing, or that's rather superficial, or whatever, however we want to judge it. So don't think like that. So this definition is not intended to point out anything special about the function performed. A function performed by an ultimate truth is just the same function performed by any impermanent phenomena. In other words, it gives a result. It functions to give a result. Okay, so you can see here how much this system, you know, really emphasizes through all these categories the difference between being something that can produce a result and something that can't. Because something that can produce a result is an ultimate truth. It's a composed phenomena. It's an impermanent thing. It's the object of a direct perceiver. You know, and then all these other things are permanent. They're only known through conceptual mind. They're conventional truths. They, you know, they're kind of imputed. They're made up. They don't really count for anything too valuable. Yeah. So this school really emphasizes direct experience. Non-conceptual direct experience, okay? So, yeah, so in a way, it's kind of like, well, yeah, there's all these permanent things. Yeah, there's all these conceptual things, but the real thing is, you know, reality is really centered on what we can perceive with our senses and our mental direct perceiver, okay? So that's what it's really emphasizing. I was just thinking maybe that's where some people get this idea of, you know, don't think too much, don't have too much conceptualization. You know, perhaps it comes from there. Okay, so rather the definition is pointing at the type of consciousness that is able to perceive impermanent phenomena. Impermanent phenomena are truths because they are existent. Okay. They are ultimate because they are objects of awareness for an ultimate consciousness. Okay, so an ultimate consciousness is going to be the best kind of consciousness there is. A final, unflawed, defensible, and reliable consciousness, a direct perceiver. Okay, Now, surely from the perspective of the upper schools, a direct perceiver, you know, knowing emptiness is definitely the ultimate consciousness, and that emptiness is the ultimate truth. But, you know, for us to look at the thermos and say this is an ultimate truth, and yippee, because I have a direct perceiver knowing its color and shape, well, then, okay. In fact, this is the way the division of existence into the two truths tracks in each of the tenet systems in terms of the consciousnesses that are able to perceive the objects. Okay. Conventional truths in this system are perceived by conventional consciousnesses. Well, this is the same in all the systems. And ultimate truths are perceived by ultimate consciousnesses. What varies from system to system is what is identified as an ultimate consciousness and what is identified as a conventional consciousness. And when they do the etymology for ultimate, one etymology is meaning it's the best, it's the supreme consciousness. Okay, so here, I mean, we would have trouble saying that, you know, my tactile consciousness that feels the smoothness or roughness of the table is a supreme consciousness. Yeah. In each of the systems, an ultimate consciousness perceives an object just as it exists. Well, that's why they say it's important. You know, that's just how it exists, you know, without any layover. Okay. But you can see there the contrast with the Madhyamaka system where, you know, no, we don't perceive things, conventional objects, exactly as they are. There is a layover because we're you know, they appear to us as truly existent. So we're not really perceiving as they are. You know, there's a mistake in there. In the system that is the point of view used in the introductory topics here, an ordinary direct perceiver, like an eye consciousness seeing blue as blue, is a consciousness free from conceptuality and is not mistaken with respect to what it appears to it. Okay, now, that isn't always the how, for example, the prasangikas see a direct perceiver. Okay, because here, direct is glossed as being free being free from conceptuality. Okay, yeah, but in the prasangika, direct is glossed as meaning not dependent on a reason. Okay, and so for that reason, prasangikas accept both conceptual and non-conceptual direct reliable cognizers. Now, when you've studied the Satantrika system and then you hear the prasangikas say that, you're horrified. You go, what? What? Double what? You know, how can you say there's a conceptual, direct, reliable cognizer? That's impossible. Well, it's impossible according to the Satantrikas, which is the viewpoint that we've learned it all in. But we have to change our viewpoint when we're studying prasangika, because prasangika says, you know, if that perception doesn't depend on a reason, then we can consider it a direct perception. For example, the second moment of an inference. So the first moment of an inference depends on a reason. The second moment doesn't. It's simply recognizing the first moment. It's a continuation of the first moment, you know, again cognizing the same object. So they would say that second moment of an inference realizing emptiness, they would call that a direct perceiver and a conceptual direct perceiver. And the Satantrikas would be horrified. I would say, you're crazy. You can't say that. Okay, so just to point out the difference here between the philosophical systems. Okay, yeah.
I think I'm dead. I just can't think very fast tonight. The second moment of an inference for prasangika is a direct perceiver. The second moment of an inference, no matter what you're inferring, doesn't require a reason. It doesn't matter what your inference is about.
Yeah, well, inferences are always correct consciousnesses, okay? And it doesn't matter what you're inferring about, yeah? They consider that a direct perceiver because it's not dependent on a reason. Whereas the lower schools, you know, something is a direct perceiver if there's no conceptuality involved, okay? Yeah. So it's quite different. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's kind of in some way giving some boost to the inferential direct perceivers. Yeah. Okay. And the proponents of the sutra school following reasoning say that what appears to a direct perceiver is always an impermanent phenomena. Now, do prasangikas agree with that? No. For example? Yeah, emptiness. Yeah. So again, here you can see how totally what a dramatic difference the prasangika has with, you know, the sutra school. In even saying that you can directly perceive something that's impermanent. Yeah? Something that's permanent. Yeah? Saying that you could directly perceive that. That's like, what? To the sutra school? There is more on consciousnesses in chapter 12. Called consciousnesses in relation to what they perceive. But understand right here that direct perceivers are not necessarily any big deal. Okay, well, they are when you talk about yogic direct perceivers that are realizing emptiness. But we'll come to that soon, because they say that a yogic direct perceiver to realizing emptiness, realizing selflessness, I should say, because they don't speak of emptiness so much. They say that yogic direct perceiver realizes selflessness implicitly, not even explicitly. Yeah? So just their whole way of framing it is very different. You know, prasangikas, there's this direct perception of something that's a permanent phenomena, you know, and permanent phenomena count, they're important. And, you know, the satantrikas are saying, well, you know, our ultimate goal is selflessness, but that's perceived by a direct perceiver. But what you're perceiving, they say, is the aggregates that are empty of a self. So you don't even know selflessness explicitly. You only know it explicitly, implicitly. What you know explicitly, what you're perceiving in your meditation on emptiness, is the aggregates that don't have a self. So what's appearing to you are impermanent phenomena. Yeah, and prasangika is saying what's appearing to you is a permanent phenomena. Very different. Very, very different. So I hope I'm not confusing you by going back and forth between the two schools. I think most of you have had enough backing in tenets to hopefully understand. And if you don't, you could actually study your text, your notes, and go look up some things you studied before. Okay, there are descriptions of extraordinary direct perceivers that are the fruit of meditation, but direct perception can also be completely pedestrian. It includes any ordinary correct perception, such as correctly perceiving the smell of coffee as coffee. Do you perceive the smell of coffee as coffee? No, you perceive the smell of coffee as the smell of coffee. Yeah, where was his editor on this one? Or seeing a patch of blue as blue. That one's okay. By the way, this does not mean thinking something like, I smell coffee, or the sky is pretty blue today, because these would be conceptual consciousnesses, not direct perceivers. This means just smelling coffee as the odor of coffee and seeing blue as blue. So one of the things I think that is very helpful here in the sutra system, the sutra's following reasoning, is differentiating between direct perception and conceptualization. Yeah, I think that is one of the things that is so helpful for our meditation practice and so helpful for mindfulness and for, you know, doing something about our afflictions, because we so often confuse conception and direct perceivers. Yeah. So that's why, for example, you know, to relate this to NVC, you know, we would say, I came in the room and this person totally, you know, ignored me and was rude to me and didn't even say hello, and they really don't like me. Okay? And in our mind, that's the truth, an objective truth out there. Yeah. From the viewpoint of the sutra school, is that a direct perceiver or is that conceptual mind?
Conceptual mind.
It's totally conceptual mind. What would the direct perceiver perceive? Somebody walked in the room. Yeah. And paid attention to something other than me. Yeah. So, you know, so here we can see, I mean, it's getting across a point that's very important in NVC about, you know, stripping away all of our interpretation that we put on things. Yeah? So whenever, you know, we're saying, oh, that person's ridiculing me. Yeah? That person's making fun of me. That person doesn't respect me. Yeah? Is that direct perceiver or conceptualization? It's all conceptualization, isn't it? Yeah, when that thought comes in our mind, and it is a thought which automatically shows it's conceptual, but when that thought comes in our mind, do we think, oh, this is a conceptual consciousness? No, we think we are directly perceiving that person's motivation to disrespect us, as if we had, you know, the divine, we had the ability to see other people's minds directly. You know, we have that super knowledge that can see that. And then, you know, the whole way we interpret it, it's all conceptual mind. Okay. Now, some conceptual mind is really useful. When we're learning about emptiness, yeah, when we're studying the Dharma, we use conceptual mind. I mean, tonight, we're using language, and we're having a teaching, and that, you know, it's full of conceptual mind. So that use of the conceptual mind is very good. But in our daily life, we don't always distinguish between a good use of conceptuality and, you know, total distorted conceptions. Yeah. So it's very interesting. So here's another assignment for you this week. As you walk around and see things, yeah, observe how, if you're seeing something really freshly, or if your mind, so often when it sees things, it makes you think of something else you've already seen. or reminds you of something else you've seen, or makes you think of something you want to see. Yeah? Like when we go out to the garden, yeah, and we see one of the tulips that's still blooming. Yeah? How much are we focused just on the color and shape of the tulip that's blooming? And how much is it, oh, that tulip is blooming. It's really beautiful. It's not like these other tulips next to it that have wilted. Or here's this beautiful tulip. I just was in Holland where they have fields of tulips, you know, and I didn't get to see a field like that. But even though I saw lots of tulips at the place I was staying, because these people were very kind and they put so many fresh flowers in my room and fresh flowers on the altar. And, you know, they really did everything going out of their way. And they were Gelug Rinpoche students. And he has a center in there for 20 years because there was somebody from Holland who we met in India who started the center. And now he also has centers in the U.S. And do you see how you're off and running? And all there was that started the whole thing was the color and shape of the tulip. Okay? So this thing about really looking in your own mind about, you know, what is just a plain old sensory data and what is your interpretation of it? And how does that interpretation then go on to think about the zillions of other unrelated topics? Yeah? Until you eventually get back to the core topic of my childhood was a disaster. And that's why I'm such a mess. You know, that's the conclusion you always have to come to in the West. Yeah? Okay? Or the conclusion of, you know, the world doesn't appreciate me, you know. That's the final end of, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
This is very short. My favorite story when I see the tulips takes me to the time when someone 3 years ago dug up the asparagus and then planted tulip bulbs. And this was quite a source of dismay for some.
Oh, let's fight over it now. Okay? So now you see, you know, there's memories which are conceptual consciousnesses. Okay? And two people remember different things, and both people are thinking, but what I remember is correct. You know, she dug it up. No, she didn't dig it up. She just planted the other ones instead. And then instantly the I comes about of I'm right. You know, my memory is right when her memory is wrong. And then it becomes really crucial that I win this argument. Yeah, because I am never wrong. And I'm not going to be humiliated by her memory being better than mine, because that might mean that I'm getting dementia. And I don't want to admit that perhaps I'm getting dementia, you know, because I'm definitely not demented. You know? Okay, so are you seeing the way the mind works with conceptuality? Okay. So there were just the sounds that she said. And then, you know, instantly we have this whole thing unfolding. Yeah? So this is our lives in samsara, isn't it? Yeah? No wonder we say samsara is unsatisfactory. Look at the way our minds are working. Okay. Yeah, so even here, you know, the smell of coffee is coffee. Okay, so the smell of coffee, you smell coffee is coffee. You know, how long do we just, you know, there's the direct perception of the smell of coffee. Then there's the thought I smell coffee. Then there's the thought, I want coffee. Then there's the thought, I'm not at the Abbey, so I can take a cup of coffee. And they won't know it. I'll confess it, but it's already after I've taken the coffee. So that way, I don't have to forgo my coffee. I'll just confess it. And they don't usually make too big of a thing about drinking coffee when you're away. Oh. She said it was decaffeinated. So the implication, again, a conceptual consciousness, yes, is that decaffeinated doesn't count as coffee. Yeah. So maybe I don't really need to confess it at all. Okay. Right. That's a good syllogism. Yeah, you have a question?
So he's making a distinction here between smelling coffee as coffee and thinking I smell coffee. Mm-hmm. And it's, I don't know, I'm trying to understand this because it seems to me like if you just smell the coffee, that's just the sense. But when you smell it as coffee, you've already gone to the label of it. Mm-hmm. And that seems like that's conceptuality.
Yeah. Yeah.
So his phrasing is a little dubious for me.
No. I mean, this is conceptuality. The thought, I'm smelling coffee, or the thought, this is the smell of coffee, is conceptual mind. It's not a direct perceiver.
Right, but he labels it as different than smelling coffee as coffee. It seems to me like once you smell coffee as coffee, you've already gone to that thought.
No, when he says smell coffee as coffee, what he means is you're just smelling coffee. You know, of course, if you think I'm smelling coffee as coffee, then that's conceptual. But what he means here is you're just smelling the coffee. You know, you're not thinking, oh, you know, is, you know, maybe this is tea that smells like coffee or something like that. It's just, yeah.
So you haven't labeled it yet?
No.
These concepts that we have, do we believe that the objects are inherently existent?
You bet. Because look at our own experience. Whatever we see, we think we're seeing the reality of it. Yeah. That person is rude to me. That person is bossing me around. We think that we're perceiving, you know, whatever, you know, sounds we hear, because all there are sounds, colors, shapes, things like that. But on the basis of just that sense information, we project, yeah, that person, you know, doesn't like me, that person is putting me down. That all of that is coming from our mind.
So we live in a world of our concepts and not what's actually there. You know, we smell coffee, but it's actually just passing little droplets of...
Yeah, well, we're having sense perception all the time. I mean, our eyes are open. We're seeing things all the time. We're hearing things all the time. But so often we live in our head, so to speak. You know, when we say live in our head, what we mean is we're stuck with all of our conceptual thoughts going round and around, confusing the objects of conceptual thoughts with actual objects. Okay. Now, sometimes our conceptual thoughts are accurate. If you think, this telephone is black, that's a correct conceptual mind, okay? So there's no problem with it. We're not putting down all conception. But if you think, oh, that telephone is black, Yeah, somebody must have, you know, not realized that you can get red telephones, which are so much more beautiful, and they got just this dull black one, you know, then you're off into conceptuality. Okay, but, you know, this exercise I'm giving you for the next week, just to watch your mind on how, based on some sense data, whether it's hearing or seeing or smelling or tasting, touching, how your conceptual mind responds after that. Yeah. Yeah, it's just amazing, you know? Okay. Another way of expressing impermanent phenomena is to call them existent phenomena that may be known explicitly by direct perception, or existent phenomena that appear to direct perception. This is why the proponents of the Sutra school following reasoning call impermanent phenomena ultimate truths. They appear to a direct perceiver just as they exist, because this school says that they inherently exist. They exist from their own side, by their own characteristics. So just as they are, that's exactly how they are appearing to your mind. And your direct valid cognizer knows them exactly as they are, without error. Okay. And Prasangikas are saying, even at the level of sense consciousness, there's mistaken appearances. And so right then and there, our problem starts. Yeah. Whereas the Sutra school is going to say, you know, the problem doesn't start with sense direct perceivers, because we're perceiving things just as they actually are from their own side. And there's no problem with that. And Prasangikas say, oh, you want to make a bet?
I'm wondering if you agree with this idea. It seems to make sense to me that Anne Klein writes in that book, anyway, the book about the Sutra of School mm-hmm. Following Reasoning.
Knowledge and liberation,
that one.
Yeah.
She says that this system, by doing this way, actually just exactly that is what they're actually setting up. This turns into be the object of negation.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like setting it up as a target to be knocked down.
Yeah.
I think is how I've heard that said by someone else.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah. And it's also, you know, this is the helpfulness of going through these different tenant systems is, you know, when you learn a system like this, well, usually you start with a Vavasika, but then this one, it's like there's a lot of agreement between this system and what we already think. So it doesn't jar us too much, but there's enough disagreement with what we already think to get us thinking about things, like what's the difference between a direct perceiver and a conceptual consciousness? And when you really think about that, that really changes how you see things. Yeah? So it shakes us up enough, but not so much, you know? So each school kind of, you know, it gives us one more degree of being shaken up. Yeah? And each higher school, what you're doing as you go up is refuting the tenets of the lower schools, you know? And especially here when it says these, you know, how we're perceiving things is exactly how they exist. Yeah. So we can see as ordinary beings, oh, that doesn't shake us up very much, you know? Oh, yes, everything really is out there, independent from my mind. There's an objective reality that we can all see. Yeah. Oh, isn't that comforting? Yeah. But by the time you get to Prasangika, or you just even get to Chittamatra, oh, there's no, you know, external objects. what we're perceiving all is related to our mind, and depending upon the latencies in our mind, which is depending upon, you know, what we've perceived before and our karma and all sorts of other things, it brings a whole new level of dependence and a whole new level of, you know, what exactly are we perceiving here? Yeah, so even with Chittamatra, they trash the two lower systems. Especially what they criticize is the Vibhasaka and the Satantrika is saying that there's partless particles. The Chittamatras are the ones that really refute that, say, doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And then the Prasangikas say, well, you're even saying that these things are arising from latencies on the mind, and, you know, you're not making any sense either. So, anyway. Okay, they appear to a direct perceiver just as they exist, together with all their individual characteristics and their subtle impermanence. Okay. Let me explain it first before you ask the question. So they say that when you perceive something, yeah, you what's appearing to your phenomena is all the qualities of that object, you know, which are also impermanent phenomena, and the quality of subtle impermanence itself, which is an impermanent phenomena, also appears to your direct perceiver, but of course you can't perceive it yet. Okay, but they say it appears.
And this works in their system because when they get, well, their ultimate truth isn't permanent.
Their ultimate truth is functioning things.
Yeah, right. So everything that you're perceiving there, even though it's not ascertained,
yeah,
is impermanent, and they don't have any, their ultimate truth is these impermanent things, mm-hmm. And then this selflessness that they realize that is implicit, is that also impermanent?
Yeah, the selflessness, I would think they would say that that is permanent, but how you know selflessness is implicit.
Right, so you don't because perceive what you're that. At,
you don't perceive selfness directly in the system.
Yeah, it has to be through a thought consciousness.
I don't know if they would say it's a thought. I don't know how they say that. If they say selflessness is permanent or impermanent, it would be difficult to say it's impermanent, but it's difficult to say it's a thought perceived by a thought consciousness too. Because they say, actually, what you're perceiving in the realization of selflessness is the aggregates devoid of a self.
Mm-hmm. So the yogic direct perceiver?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So selfless, you know, I don't think you would, I don't think they would say selflessness was a permanent phenomena for that reason, you know. But saying that it's selflessness is impermanent and it changes momentarily, that sounds kind of weird too.
It's maybe where it falls apart.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the realization of subtle impermanence, mm-hmm. is also a yogic direct perceiver
for them. Mm-hmm.
But it's they're perceiving an ultimate truth, which means they're seeing. What does that mean? I mean,
it means subtle impermanence is an impermanent phenomena.
They see, but they don't ever get to a point where they apprehend it. They think with a sense consciousness itself.
No, the subtle impermanence is an abstract composite. Okay, one of those, the category that is neither form nor consciousness. So it's impermanent, but to perceive those things, you have to perceive something else first.
That's also implicit.
Yeah, I would think so.
Also,
implicit. Subtle impermanent. What?
It seems like you couldn't perceive it directly because it's
impermanent. This is the problem with abstract composites that I've never really understood, is, you know, all those things that are impermanent should be perceived by a direct perceiver. But then the question is, do you perceive them explicitly or implicitly?
They're perceived but not ascertained.
Well, that's when you're talking about sense consciousnesses. But when we're talking about a yogic direct perceiver, they're perceived implicitly. Yeah? But they're impermanent. I mean, subtle impermanence is impermanent. And I would think it's perceived implicitly, because you know subtle impermanence by seeing an object change momentarily.
This is your mental consciousness.
This is your mental consciousness. It's a yogic direct perceiver.
It seems like different people hold different thoughts about whether it's mental or sense consciousness for subtle impermanence in the different schools.
Oh, no, subtle impermanence has to be mental consciousness.
Be mental.
Yeah.
I know you've said that, but I thought I might have read
it
differently.
They say it appears to a sense consciousness, but it isn't perceived by a sense consciousness.
Okay, that's kind of weird.
Okay. Because what is perceived by sense consciousnesses, if you go through your five sense consciousnesses, none of them have an object that is subtle impermanence. Yeah? Because subtle impermanence is that category that is neither form nor consciousness. Yeah? That's why it seems to me that all those things that are abstract phenomena would be perceived implicitly. That's the way it seems to me. But you can ask around and think about it yourself and see what you come up with. Yeah.
I wanted to ask about another category of impermanent phenomena. Mm-hmm. Consciousnesses.
Yeah.
How are they perceived? Directly. I mean, I might be able to be aware of my own mind, but not of others.
Yeah, and again, by concentration, yeah, by the dhyanas, then you can perceive other people's consciousnesses directly.
And that's being perceived with the mind, not with sense consciousness.
Right. Yeah, with your mental consciousness.
So it also kind of conflicts with this idea that impermanent phenomena are all... Well, I guess that is direct perception.
Yeah, they're directly perceived, but there's different kinds of direct perceivers. Yeah, there's sense direct perceivers, there's mental direct perceivers, there's yogic direct perceivers. Okay, but we're coming to that whole subject of consciousness. We're just not there yet. Okay, now we're going into permanent phenomena. So a permanent phenomenon is a conventional truth defined as a phenomenon that is ultimately unable to perform a function. Poor baby. Yeah? So, you know, in a modern capitalist society, if you can't perform a function, you're useless. Okay? But not necessarily here. Conventional truths are not able to perform any function because they are permanent and static. Since in the system of the sutra school following reasoning, ultimate truths are equated with impermanent phenomena, conventional truths are equated with permanent phenomena. The very reason they are called ultimate truths and conventional truths is because of the consciousnesses that are able to perceive the two truths. We may understand any existent by a thought consciousness, a conceptual knower, but conventional truths can only be understood by a conceptual consciousness, and ultimate truths may be understood explicitly by a direct perceiver. Okay? So here there's a difference, yeah? Permanent phenomena are never known by a direct perceiver. Yeah, from this school. Never. Prasangika has changed that, but this school says never. Okay? So permanent phenomena are only known by conceptual consciousnesses. Yeah. And ultimate truths, okay, which means functioning things, they may be known by a conceptual consciousness or they may be known by a direct perceiver. Because I can have a direct perceiver seeing the color and shape of the thermos, and I can also think about the thermos. Okay, so the thermos can be an object of both my sense direct perceiver and my conceptual mental consciousness. Yeah, so don't think, oh, conceptual minds only perceive permanent things and direct perceivers only perceive impermanent things, because conceptual consciousnesses can also know impermanent things. Okay, but it knows them differently than a direct, in a way that's different than how a direct perceiver knows it, because a conceptual consciousness knows it via the conceptual appearance. It doesn't know it directly. We may understand any existent by a thought consciousness, a conceptual knower, but conceptual truths can only be understood by a conceptual consciousness, and ultimate truths may be understood explicitly by a direct perceiver. Okay. Ultimate truths are truths for an ultimate consciousness, and conventional truths are truths for a conventional consciousness or an obscured mind. So here, obscured just means that you have a conceptual appearance. Yeah, for Prasangika, when you say it's obscured, obscured has a totally different meaning. It means it's appearing inherently existent, even though it isn't. The main problem identified here for conceptual consciousnesses is not that they are unreliable, for it may be that you do indeed perceive something clearly and correctly by a conventional conceptual consciousness. The problem is that a conceptual consciousness does not perceive its object directly, but understands it through a representative internal image. Thus, it does not see the thing as it is. Okay, because it's perceiving it via that medium of the conceptual appearance. And a conceptual appearance it generally knows the object. And it takes bits of perception of similar objects or the same object perceived at different times, and it puts it all together to form some general image. And that is what is known conceptually. So that's very different than a direct perceiver. So here's another experience to another exercise this next week. Okay? This is a mealtime exercise. So you're sitting there with your bowl in front of you, yeah? And before you eat something, look at how your mind expects that to taste. Yeah, because you know how we always rearrange our bites and puts little bits together so that we have the optimum pleasure from each bite. And to do that, we have to have an idea of how we think each thing in our bowl is going to taste. Yeah. So, you know, look at the spinach or look at the, you know, tofu or whatever it is, and have an idea of how you think that is going to taste by looking at it, smelling it, and so on. Then take a little bit and taste it. And see if how you thought, compare how you thought it was going to taste with what the actual taste is. Yeah. A good example is, I don't know if everybody else had problems with the bran muffins. Yeah. But to me, the bran muffins taste bitter. And I had a bran muffin in front and I thought, this is going to be really good. I know what bran muffins taste like, you know, and it has fruit in it, and that makes it double good. And then I tasted it, and It was very, there was something bitter in it. I don't know, maybe I just got the batch with,
Rhubarb.
It was rhubarb?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was like too much baking soda or something. That was the rhubarb? Okay. Yeah, but it was very interesting because my conception of how I thought that was going to taste and what the actual taste was were two totally different things. Yeah. And so it's very interesting to watch, especially around things that we're attached to, because we have an expectation that it's going to taste a certain way, or it's going to sound a certain way, or look a certain way, and we're eagerly anticipating the sensual experience. And then, what's another example? Sometimes the sound of the conch, you know, before you've heard the sound of the conch, you imagine, you know, how it's going to sound. And then you hear somebody who's never blown it before sound it. Yeah? And then you can really see the difference between knowing something conceptually and knowing something directly. Yeah, they're very different.
To me, it seems strange to say that you can know an object through a concept about it. Because wouldn't you distinguish between the general image you concoct in your mind and the actual thing as it exists? How could you say you know something correctly that's kind of just made up by your mind?
Well, that's why they say that direct perceivers are the really valuable ones, this school, you know, and because it knows it exactly as it is, whereas conceptuality, you just know it generally. But we use conceptual minds all the time, and they are reliable. You know, when somebody gives you directions how to go somewhere, you develop a mental picture in your mind, and that will serve to get you where you're going. Yeah, so that's good enough. It works. But hearing the description of, you know, if you're looking for a certain building, how you picture it when you hear a description is going to be different than what it's like when you actually see it. Yeah. Okay, but you do know it through the description. Okay, so the division of existence into the two truths shows the priority given to direct perception. Yeah, so that's the point here. Yeah. Again, since ultimate truths, impermanent phenomena, and functioning things are mutually inclusive, and conventional truths and permanent things, permanent phenomena are mutually inclusive, they compare to the other phenomena in the same way as described above.
When we do visualization practices, what kind of mind is that considered?
What do you think?
It seems conceptual.
Mm-hmm. It's conceptual until when you get high realizations, it becomes an actual deity that you're perceiving directly. Okay. We're starting a new category here, but we're almost at the end of our time. Do you have other questions or concerns or anything? Shall I? Yeah.
I've often wondered why they talk about inferential cognizers and direct perceivers as the two types of awareness that know things, because I wonder why they don't instead say inferential cognizers and direct reliable cognizers. Why is it they're including direct perceivers, which also includes...
Wait a minute, why don't they...
Okay. So in this section, we've been talking about how all objects are either known most perfectly by an inferential cognizer.
Yeah.
So that's the... Or
a direct perceiver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I wonder why they're talking about direct perceiver, which also includes these awarenesses to which an object appears but it's not ascertained. Why don't they just, and subsequent cognizers?
Yeah, because that's not a reliable. When the object is the appears but is not ascertained, I'm not quite sure it even counts as a direct perceiver. Some might, but some may not. In just thinking about it, because you know, they always give the example of somebody talking while you're intently looking at something, okay? If you're really intently looking at it, yeah, are you actually hearing it? Well, they say it appears but not ascertained. But, you know, would they really count that as a direct perceiver?
Well, there may be different takes on this.
Yeah.
Lodi Rinpoche includes it in direct perceivers, and that's how I've learned it in Lohrig. And so it's always been a question. And
okay, but but direct perceiver doesn't mean reliable cognizer.
Right, that's the point I'm making. I don't understand why they don't say direct reliable cognizer.
Oh.
Instead of this general, what sounds like a general category.
I see. Okay. Why do they just say it's emphasizing direct perceivers instead of direct, reliable, you know, perceivers.
Because that's really what they're talking about.
Right, right.
Using this general term, and here we're trying to be so precise, so I don't understand
the discrepancy. Yeah. Maybe it's just a way of, you know, well, they're just talking here about they're differentiating between direct perceivers and conceptual minds, and they haven't gotten into the whole subject of what's reliable and what's not yet. Because you can have, you know, it's a whole dividing things by direct perceivers and conceptual minds is different than dividing things of reliable cognizers and unreliable cognizers. So, you know, it's two different categories. So maybe they're just focusing on this one category here and then giving you that background so that then when they get to the one about reliable and unreliable, you'll understand it a little bit better. Makes sense to me.
So along the lines of what she was just saying, would something, say, an optical illusion be considered a direct perception?
Mm-hmm.
That's what my eyes are perceiving.
Right.
But it's not reliable.
Right.
Would it be considered a direct perception?
The colors and shapes that you're perceiving are perceived by the colors and shapes are a direct perceiver. Yeah. But the mind that thinks that's a real object is incorrect.
As if someone sees two moons, that's a false.
Right. Or you look the face in the mirror. Yeah, you're seeing colors and shapes, and there's no fault with your eye consciousness when you see the face in the mirror. The problem comes when you think it's a real face.
Right. I guess I'm thinking about when you have a fault with a sense consciousness of some sort that distorts things.
Yeah, then that's not a reliable cognizer.
But it's still direct perception.
It's a wrong consciousness. That's what you would put under. Yeah. And that's, so the question is, and here's, it's coming back to your question, Venerable Sepal, if something appears but not is not ascertained, you know, is there any overlapping between wrong consciousnesses and direct perceivers? Is there any overlapping between consciousnesses to which something appears but is not ascertained and direct perceivers? That's the question we're asking. You're saying no? But you just told me that that when you hear, you know, when you're intent on looking at something and you hear something, that that's a direct perceiver.
It's non-conceptual and non-mistaken, but a wrong consciousness necessarily is mistaken in some way, even if it's non-conceptual, like pressing your eye and saying
two moons. But
it doesn't fit the definition of a direct perceiver.
Because it's a wrong consciousness.
Because it's mistaken. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then it's almost like saying if it's a direct perceiver, it's necessarily a direct reliable perceiver.
Well, not if you include...
Yeah, so this is what we have to look.
We'll get to that in chapter 12.
Yeah, this is what we have to look at. If there's a sound that, you know, doesn't you hear, but it doesn't register with you, yeah, there's one category of phenomena in the seven knowers that says, you know, that's a phenomena of this and a consciousness of this category. You know, our question is there something that is both a direct perceiver and a perceiver of something that appears but is not known? And is there a common locus of a direct perceiver and a wrong consciousness? For example, when you see two moons. Okay. So this is, you know, we can look in the low-rig texts for the answer to this. My guess is that they may say it is called a direct perceiver, but it's not a real direct perceiver. Sometimes they do things like that. Yeah.
I wanted to kind of switch gears and just see if you could. To me, what we talked about tonight has a lot to do with my daily practice in terms of doing like the four establishments of mindfulness,
mm-hmm.
and also using antidotes. And what I wanted just to see if you could comment on from your own practice is, like, if in my experience, if I just use like being aware of things, being mindful of things, like getting my mind calm to like, observe what's going on, that's very useful, but I actually am in your camp where I find that I need to negate the thoughts that are bringing me these distorted, like, for instance, if I think I'm being criticized or whatever, mm-hmm. and then I go onto the cushion and I look, what really happened there? What was the observation and what was my interpretation, my thoughts and this and that? So in my practice, it helps me to get my mind calm enough to be able to kind of take all that apart and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also find, that being able to actually identify what are the thoughts I'm having versus what I'm observing is very powerful.
Yes.
And so it seems like, though, that there's like a kind of a fine line in knowing. I mean, it takes a long time to get to a place where you can see any of this stuff. You know,
where you can.
It took years to be able to see some of this stuff, to get my mind calm enough to see any of this.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if you have any, I don't know, like, how would you make that penetrate deeper, I guess is the question.
I think concentration helps, but you just have to sit there and, like, you know, what's the thought that's going on? You know, I feel uncomfortable. What's the thought that's going on that's causing this discomfort? You just have to sit there with it. I haven't found a quick, cheap, and easy way.
When I think about what causes the changes that we get out of our practice, some of it to me seems like it's the repetition of negating those thoughts that are so...
Yeah.
And do again and again and again, so that when it comes up, I can quickly say, been there, done that, this is wrong.
Yep.
And that's kind of as good as it gets for me.
But that's pretty good if you're angry and you can very quickly see anger is a wrong consciousness and it's not serving me.
People that work with depression more in that way, like look at the thoughts and like, don't do this to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
It also seems like when you do that practice where you identify the thoughts that aren't helpful and turn your mind from them, then your experience of feeling calmer and settled and clearer
mm-hmm.
is what then really reinforces to keep going in that direction.
And also for me, that antidote.
Yes.
The feeling of that antidote.
Yeah.
This is what I'm helping lately. Yeah. It's just knowing what I should be having in my mind, and then just putting my mind there, and the feeling of that is so nice compared to the misery of the other. It's like, you know, that kind of seems where it's at.
Yeah, yeah. And what's happening there is you're getting into a positive loop because you're practicing, then you're feeling better, so you want to practice more, and then you feel better more.
There's more to it. It seems like that's just it.
Yeah. Remember how His Holiness, at one teaching he was giving in California, somebody asked His Holiness, you know, what is the easy way to gain realizations? Yeah. And His Holiness teared up, and he told the story of when Rachumpa was leaving Milarepa to go meditate, and Milarepa says, I want to give you one last powerful teaching. And he showed him the calluses on his tush. Okay, let's dedicate. Okay, let's just review what your homework is. Okay? Okay, first assignment.
Justify some behavior or emotions with a syllogism.
Yeah. Okay, that's the first one. Second one?
Second one is, as you walk around and see things, observe if you're seeing something freshly, or if the mind is reminded by something you have already seen or something you want to see. See how we evaluate what is sensory data, what is interpretation.
Yeah. Okay. And then the third one?
How does your mind expect things to taste, conceptually versus actual?
Yeah. Okay. So try that out tomorrow, and then compare notes after the bell rings. Yeah. So remember, there's this one thing after they teach direct perceivers of, they have facsimile direct perceivers.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So, and there's a list of five or six things under that. So we have to see what that is.